chatterer, get to silence, and to be able to focus on the breath and sustain your attention on something. Because if somebody tries to practice loving kindness meditation and they haven't got the basic skills of meditation, of learning how to be quiet, learning how to be present, and learning how to sustain your attention on something, again, loving kindness is just too hard to do. You know, you can't really keep your attention there long enough for it to work. And just like any other meditation, where you have no success, you just get frustrated and give up. So I like to do a basic training, first of all, of breath meditation. And then once that breath meditation has been reasonably successful, then it's a good idea to try your hand at other types of meditation, like metta, like loving kindness. It's not an easy meditation to do. It's not an easy meditation to do properly, that is, because it takes a lot of wisdom. Very often that people start loving kindness meditation with themselves or, you know, with an object which is hard to meditate on, especially hard to give loving kindness towards. As I was mentioning in the talk on the hindrances, the loving kindness is the antidote to ill will, and ill will is the antidote to loving kindness. So if you have any degree of ill will, then it just becomes a blockage to loving kindness and you just can't generate it at all. And so, yeah, because ill will is so pernicious and is so prevalent, you know, in our minds, it needs to be, meditation on loving kindness needs to be approached very carefully. And that is why that when I was practicing loving kindness meditation years ago, we realized that you had to actually start with something easy. Instead of starting with something hard like yourself or like all beings, to start with something which it was easy to generate thoughts and feelings of metta towards. And that's why that I actually started with imaginary objects. I'd do some visualization. I'd visualize a little kitten, because I like cats. I visualize a little kitten in my mind and give loving kindness towards that. If you've got a kitten, a puppy, or a little baby, one person who understood what I was meaning here didn't have any pets at home, but they happened to be just growing a little pot plant. And so they imagined their pot plant at home. And they gave it such loving kindness, you know, to try and encourage it to grow well and to burst into flower. And they developed those warm, loving, caring, nurturing, tender feelings of just like a mother towards her child. Only her child was a pot plant. And by doing that, that one develops the feelings of warmth and kindness towards something. It's only then, once the feelings of loving kindness are warm and warmth are reasonably strong, that you can start changing the object to somebody else. And then to change it to someone close to you. Just like having a slide projector, you just change the image in the slide projector. So instead of that little kitten or that puppy or that pot plant, you have somebody else, someone close to you. The point being here is that loving kindness is very often compared to like a fire, like a warmth, like a hot glow. And in order to start a fire, you've got to begin with things which are easy to take the flame. And that's why many people, when they start a fire, use paper or fire lighters. And from that you start. Once the fire is going with the paper, you put on little twigs, kindling. And from kindling, you move up to the bigger pieces of wood. And it's only when the fire is very strong, like a huge bonfire, can you put in the big, wet, sappy logs. And the big, wet, sappy logs are your enemies, including yourself sometimes. And then it's very easy to have loving kindness towards yourself once the fire is strong. And it's quite interesting that why it is, it's so hard to give that full type of loving kindness towards yourself. But if you follow the loving kindness meditation in that way, you'll find that leaving yourself down the list somewhere, when your fire is very strong and you get to yourself, you can bathe yourself in loving kindness without any problem whatsoever. And that forgiveness, which is part of loving kindness, is so easy to give to yourself. You can let go of all of your mistakes and all of your faults and things which you're not proud of, and they disappear very easily. But you try and do that in a normal state of consciousness when the fire is not established, and it's almost impossible to do. So this becomes a skillful means how to give loving kindness towards yourself, by starting on something small and then working up to the harder objects, the bigger logs, the sappier logs, the more damp logs. And even you can get to the point where people who have hurt you, who have abused you, who have really sort of done rotten things to you, you can get loving kindness towards them as well, the huge wet sappy logs. You can put them on the fire, and the dampness in them sizzles out very quickly. And that dampness is the ill will, the hurt. And you find that even your worst enemies can take the flame of your loving kindness, and they're no longer enemies anymore. And so it's a very powerful way of developing loving kindness towards all beings. Once you have the enemies under the flame, that's when you start taking loving kindness towards more a meditation, which leads not just to a sense of harmony between other beings, but use it as a meditation which leads to the jhanas. Because once you have the loving kindness meditation generated on objects, then it's a time to take away the major focus on the object of the meditation and just to go to the happiness of that meditation, and to put more focus on the beauty of loving kindness. So in just the same way that we're doing this breath meditation to get to that stage of the beautiful breath, so here you get to the stage of the beautiful loving kindness. You actually feel what loving kindness is. You're not really paying too much focus on the object, but what it actually feels like to have loving kindness, what loving kindness is as a mental object, especially the beauty of that. Loving kindness is naturally very beautiful, very attractive, very delightful. And so it's not that difficult to notice its aspect of deliciousness. And in the same way that when you've got the beautiful breath in the meditation, you allow the breath to disappear and just to keep the beauty, and this is manifested as a nimitta, in the same way that when one does loving kindness meditation, you allow the objects of loving kindness to disappear, and all you're left with that's the beauty of loving kindness, the essence of metta, which will be a very brilliant and beautiful nimitta in the mind, and that will take you into jhanas very easily, just because of the deliciousness, the delightfulness, the brilliance of that mind state. And that's where it becomes apamana. Apamana means like without measure, not measuring your loving kindness on the objects of loving kindness. Not measuring it because you're having loving kindness on a on a being, or on yourself, or on an enemy. Not even having it on all beings, but taking away the object of all beings, or this being, or that being, and making it without bounds, without an object, just the essence of loving kindness by itself. And that becomes a mental object, which takes you away from the five senses and into the realm of the mind. So loving kindness meditation is a useful thing to do, because not only does it lead you into the jhanas, and from those jhanas lead you into deep insight, as I've been saying all week, but also on the way it solves a lot of problems with yourself and with other people. It learns how to create more peace and harmony. However, that loving kindness has its benefits and has its dangers. Usually we talk about the 11 benefits of loving kindness meditation. And the first three benefits are very important to you on times of retreat, all to do with sleeping. If you practice loving kindness meditation, you go to sleep easily. So you don't need sleeping tablets, you don't lie in your bed for tossing and turning. You do loving kindness meditation, you go to sleep easily. And number two, you wake up contented, full of energy. So if you do loving kindness meditation, you don't need a morning cup of coffee. Yeah. When you wake in the morning, you feel so good and so happy. And so loving kindness meditation would be a wonderful thing for people to do when they have to get up on Monday morning to go to work. If they did loving kindness meditation, it was really working on Monday morning, they'll be whoopee, zippity doo dah, another lovely day to get up and go to work. Because what loving kindness meditation is doing here is overcoming the fault finding mind, the ill will. And the only reason why people get upset when they get up on Monday morning is because of their dwelling in fault finding and ill will. As I was saying throughout this retreat, to get that positive attitude, if you have to go to Monday morning, whoopee, what a wonderful opportunity to make some money so you can make some donations. If you didn't go to work, I mean, how could there be any donations made? An opportunity to make good karma, isn't it, going to work? So whoopee, what a lovely opportunity. I'm working on it, You've got to go to work anyway, haven't you? So you've got no choice in the matter. You can either go to work kicking and screaming, or you can go to work with happiness and with joy. And that's something which I've learned to do, because what you have to do, you might as well enjoy it. Put fun into it. And loving kindness is a way of doing that. Because once you have loving kindness, it's not just to beings, it's also loving kindness to things, even like emotional states. Just like a mother loves her only child. That's the Lord Buddha's description, metaphor for loving kindness. Those of you who have had children, when they wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, after they've also woken up at 1 o'clock and 12 o'clock and 11 o'clock, you still love them, don't you? It's amazing just how a mother would love her child, even though it causes so much physical stress. And if you have that degree of loving kindness towards your job, even though it makes you get up at times you don't want to get up, even though it causes you so much physical stress. There's another way of looking at that. When a mother loves her only child, she doesn't always like her child. The love is something different. And what that actually love is, that loving kindness, is a sense of embracing the experience as it is. There's a simile which I've used, I've mentioned it here before, earlier on in this retreat, is that using the words of my father, who as a young boy, as a young man, took me aside and said, "The door of my heart's open to you no matter what you've ever done in your life." And that was something which was very powerful to me as a young 14-year-old. He was saying, no matter what I ever do, he'd never take his love away from me. That's the love of a mother towards her child. Even if you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, the door of my heart will always be open to you. You're still my child, my baby. I might not like it, but I'd always love you. So that degree of loving kindness was not liking, but embracing, being at peace with, opening the heart to. And this is what I was meaning when we say to have loving kindness to your job. You've got to do it, open your heart to it. Give it something which is more useful than just ill will and hatred and negativity. So whatever it is you have to do in life, the door of my heart is open to you. Even if it's sometimes painful things, or unpleasant things, such as you've got to sit in meditation for another hour. Meditation, the door of my heart is open to you, come in. So there's no resisting, even if it's to the breath. Breath, the door of my heart is open to you. Come in. So this is the ability to embrace with a sense of goodwill, to welcome things in, rather than to have them come in grudgingly. It's taking away the ill will, which I did mention in my talk on the hindrances, is ill will not towards just people, but to things as well. In the same way that someone can have ill will towards the... I remember this Mike had ill will towards his sewing machine. He was sewing his robe and the needle kept on breaking. I actually saw him this was in a monastery in Thailand. He was pushing this sewing machine backwards and forwards, "You stupid machine, you stupid machine." And the sewing machine did do it on purpose. remember that, anyone ever seen that 40 Towers where the man's car breaks down and he ends up beating it? and saying, I warned you many times, Akar, don't say I didn't warn you. We can get angry towards a car, we can get angry towards a sewing machine, we can get angry towards anything. In the same way, we can have loving kindness towards anything. Having loving kindness towards these things actually helps. It means you're softer and you're more caring. You don't drive your car so harshly and it lasts much longer. And you don't drive your life so harshly and it's much easier. And you don't drive your body so harshly, so it's more comfortable when you sit in meditation. Hopefully you can maybe understand that why I've told everyone to be gentle in this retreat. Because you started off this retreat with that sort of encouragement for loving kindness towards your meditation practice. Take it easy. You don't want to sort of force this meditation practice because that's just generating more ill will. And that ill will only cause tension, will never create sort of the happy states of mind which will lead to samadhi, which will lead to insight. So the loving kindness is like this acceptance, this embracing, which is liberating. So not only does it mean that you don't take in all the problems of the day into your sleep, you have that loving kindness, you have goodwill towards yourself, which includes the forgiveness, the letting go. And it means you sleep restfully, especially on a retreat, because you don't have all that much time to sleep. You have to be very efficient with your sleep. It's the same with when you go to work, you have a very busy job. When you sleep, you have to make sure you sleep well. So you do wake up contented. Usually people wake up discontent because they take worries, they linger on the past, or they worry about the future, about going to work, what they have to do the next day. That's what causes the restless sleep. So by doing this, the Buddha said, by doing loving kindness, you have easy to get to sleep, you wake up contented, you have no bad dreams. You sleep very peacefully and very deeply. He said also, so not only do people like you, but even devas, non-human beings like you, even animals like you, and the dog doesn't go out and bark to you. And there's lots of stories about monks who live in the forests, living in the jungles, who because of their loving kindness, they get visited by animals. One of the stories I tell about loving kindness was of this monk in Thailand who was sitting in the forest together with a lot of other monks when a king cobra came to see him. You've probably heard this story before, but it's still a lovely story. And this king cobra came up, and all the other monks were looking at this, and it raised its hood right in front of this monk. You know what this monk did? He sort of got his hand out and patted it on the head and said, thank you for coming to visit me. I love that story. And of course, well, nothing happened at all because, you know, this monk had lots of loving kindness. An animal would never harm you if you've got so much kindness. He was the same monk who came to visit my monastery some years ago. The monastery down at Serpentine, but we're still doing a lot of building. And that day, we had a visit from the mayor of our local council, of our shire. And it was this Australian man. He came in his nice suit, and he had this, like many Australians, had this big beer belly. But, you know, we were all on our best behavior because, you know, we wanted to get permission to build this and to build that. You can't sort of upset your local council, especially the mayor. And before we could stop him, this monk, to our horror, went straight up to this fat Australian and started rubbing him on his stomach. And straight away we thought, okay, that's it, no more building permission, no more huts or halls or our monastery. But the wonderful thing is, it's one of the lovely memories I have of this monk and of that sort of council. Well, he later became a really good friend, and I went to his funeral. And this councillor, this important personage, started like gurgling like a baby. He loved every minute of it. of having his stomach sort of patted and rubbed. But I wouldn't encourage you to do that. The only reason was because he had such loving kindness and he had this such wonderful smile when he was doing it that the counselor just, he melted. You know, the power of loving kindness. And I've seen that many, many times with Ajahn Chah, with other monks who practice that loving kindness. It's marvellous to see just how, whatever you do, it seems to be that human beings love you. They just like to be around you because of that loving kindness. And not only human beings, but other beings as well. That's why they say you're protected. If you have loving kindness, that people do protect you. Even like when I was going in jail, in the high security jail, which I used to go to visit, that they decided to have a new security procedure. That because, you know, sometimes people were jumped on and some of the women's social workers raped and things, because these prisoners were some pretty rough guys. And so they gave us these little pens, like fountain pen or biro pens, which were supposed to put in the top pocket. Of course, it's very difficult as a monk to have these things. And I was told by the security at the front there, if anyone jumps you, that on the ceiling they just put in these little like smoke detectors. And he said, just point the pen at the detector and press, and then the alarms will come and we'll be there in 30 seconds to save you. And it's supposed to be top secret, don't tell anybody. They'd only just been put in there. And of course, as soon as I went into my meditation group and I had this pen there, they said, oh, you got one of those as well. Everyone knew what it was. And one of the prisoners actually said, do you really think that you'd have time to press that before we jumped you? And I said, actually, probably not. He said, no, you wouldn't have time. If we wanted to jump you, we'd get there before you could even touch that pen. But then he said something so beautiful, I always remember. He said, but if anyone jumped you, I'd get them first. He's my mate. And they sort of appreciated so much that someone has spent the time just to go and visit them and taught meditation and you know, given up their time for them, that they would do anything for you. And that was actually what happens. If you've got loving kindness to others, other people will have loving kindness towards you. And even hardened prisoners will sort of protect you and stand up for you. So it's nice actually to see just the way that that loving kindness does create those sort of friends and that protection for you. They even say, I'm not quite sure if you have trouble with bushfires over here, but we have trouble with bushfires in West Australia. And loving kindness is supposed to protect you from fires as well. So by doing lots of metta, loving kindness, I think it's all the devas, they see a fire coming and they blow it out for you. Because they want to protect you. But the best, one of the other benefits of loving kindness meditation is that you have like serene features. You don't have to have all these cosmetics and you don't have to go to have facelifts. Metta is the Buddhist answer to facelifts. Because you look beautiful. It's true, isn't it, that a person, people who have lots of loving kindness, just when they smile, there's something extremely attractive about their features. And having that loving kindness, you know, means you are serene and beautiful in your facial features. The other day I was mentioning about one of the little similes which the Buddha gave, that for the Aryas, the noble ones, that their, what is it, their beauty is their sila, is their virtuous conduct. Their happiness is their jhanas. And their wealth is their brahmavihara, their loving kindness. It's what you can give to other people. That's what wealth is. But an arya, an arahat, especially the monastic, a monk or a nun, they haven't got any money to give dana. Now they can't go and give food to anybody because they haven't got food. But their wealth, what the Aryas can give to others, their dana, is the four brahmaviharas. They can give loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity. So that's the wealth, the store of goods which you can have to serve society and to give to society. And again, their power was the lack of defilements, you know, which gives you the power. Yes, the obstacles to power, the obstacles to achieving what you need to do in the world are all gone. So this is like some of the benefits of loving kindness. But in these 11 benefits, the next one in the list is that you can very easily get samadhi. The mind is very easily concentrated. And for those of you who have been having a hard time getting concentrated, this might be the answer for you. To do a bit more loving kindness, a bit more gentleness, goodwill towards oneself. I already mentioned when I was talking about the hindrances that the ill will is a very powerful and deep hindrance to good meditation, successful meditation. And hopefully you've been having a look at that in your mind to check out whether that is the obstacle for you gaining the peaceful states. Whether actually you're deliberately stopping yourself from getting peaceful states. Remember, these aren't very easy things to see. And that the only way you can really know this, and know it's not one of these blind spots I was talking about last night, is actually to try loving kindness. You know, the door of my heart's open to me. I wish myself goodwill. And I deserve peace. I deserve happiness. I don't need to sort of burden myself with all these thoughts and worries and all this fault finding and self-criticism. Especially at this time of the retreat. You know, you've been meditating for, was it 6-7 days already? How much have you got so far? What have you achieved? I'm really hopeless. I'm really stupid. I bet everyone else is at least in third jhana now. But not me. I'm hopeless. And with all of those, with all of those sort of ill will thoughts inside of yourself, you know, you're stopping yourself, you know, getting anywhere. So the goodwill towards yourself is, isn't it good? After all 7 days, I've got as far as present moment awareness. So that's that encouragement towards yourself, that goodwill towards yourself, that acceptance of yourself. The door of my heart is open to me no matter how far I get. Now hopefully that you can see the reason why this overcomes ill will, while loving kindness leads to deep meditation. Because from loving kindness we get contentment. A mother loves her child just as that child is. Even if the child goes to jail, even if the child fails in the world. A mother has a certain degree of contentment. No matter what you do, you're still my child. And I'll still always love you. If you have that degree of loving kindness towards your meditation, look, no matter what the content of my mind is, even if it's all over the place, I can be at peace with you. Meditation, I can be content no matter how far you've got in this retreat. From that contentment, from that acceptance, you'll find that things start to become still. It's from contentment that we have, or rather from acceptance, we have this contentment which stops us messing around and trying to make things different, which stops us changing things and moving somewhere else other than just being here. It's from that contentment that the meditation grows and grows and grows and gets deeper and deeper and deeper. We've used a simile already of the lotus. Meditation is just warming up the lotus. When the lotus closes at night, all lotuses close at night. In the early morning, when the first rays of the sun strike the outer petals of the lotus, then only after a while do those outer petals start to open. And that gives an opportunity for the sun to strike the next layer of petals. And when they warm up, they open up too. And that gives the opportunity for the sun to strike the next layer of petals. Layer by layer by layer, they open up. Revealing, as in the Mahayana simile, revealing the jewel in the heart of the lotus, in the innermost petal of that lotus. In this simile, each of these different layers of petals are the different stages of meditation. And loving kindness, attention, acceptance, contentment can be looked upon as the sun which is warming those petals. So in the same way that you develop silent present moment awareness, you're completely content to be present. You have loving kindness towards the present moment, full acceptance of it. Present moment, just come in here, no matter who you are, no matter what you are, I have goodwill towards the present moment. And you warm up that present moment, you don't move away from it. Because as soon as the sun moves away from the petals start to close again. You have to start warming it up all over again. It has to have this sustained warmth from the outermost petal. And when that outermost petal is warmed up, it opens up by itself to reveal what's inside, which is silence. Silence is right at the heart of the present moment. You just need to warm that up with sustained attention, with loving kindness. Just silence, please come in. I'm just so content to be silent. I don't want to rush off to somewhere else. I'm just fully content. And with that acceptance, with that loving kindness, the door of my heart is fully open to the silence. Then that warms up long enough to reveal what's inside that, which is the breath. And just to be with the breath. As you warm it up and have the acceptance of the breath, and I've already mentioned the power of loving kindness towards the breath, this beautiful breath which has been feeding you oxygen, which has been doing all of this work for you ever since you were born. And have you ever said thank you to your breath? Do you really appreciate it? Have you got that sense of like warmth, like your breath is your child? Lovely breath, thank you so much. That loving kindness and that goodwill towards the breath, it's like warming that next layer of the lotus. That opens up and the beautiful breath emerges. And when the beautiful breath emerges, you just be with that. You don't need to rush off anywhere else. Just so happy just to have a beautiful breath, just so content. And then that opens up by itself. The next level is right within the beautiful breath. You don't need to throw away that lotus to get another lotus, which you think might be more powerful. Just stay with the place you're at, more contentment, more warming that lotus with loving kindness, with acceptance, with attention, with loving attention. And then it opens up into the nimitta. It's a beautiful nimitta. But even the nimitta needs loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to you, no matter how powerful you are, no matter how frightening you may be, no matter how awesome. Now, loving kindness also has trust. And that's a very important aspect of this stage of meditation, to give trust to what you're doing. Because only when there's trust can you really let go of the doer. A baby trusts its mother so much that the baby can go to sleep in the mother's arms. Even though for a baby, up in the mother's arms is a long way down to the floor. But never once does the baby get afraid that you might drop it. If you carried me in your arms, I'd be very afraid. Not only because I'm very heavy, but you probably would drop me after a while. But if it was like your baby, you'd never drop your baby. And so that's why the baby can go fully asleep, completely trusting in the mother. In that simile, that the doer, this will, this chaitanya, can go completely asleep and just leave you with the pure consciousness of the jhanas, only with trust. That's why at that stage, when nimittas come up, I often advise people who are afraid or cannot get deeper and the nimitta comes up and then disappears again, to give trust and confidence to that which is in front of you. Even just to make a small suggestion that nimitta, I give you my full trust, take over. And allow the doer to disappear. And just allow the process to take over. Just like that you're driving a car and you give the person sitting next to you, okay, you take over the driving now. So you can go in the back and have a rest. That's similar to what you have to do. A lot of people don't trust other things. The lack of trust we have is very much because of a lack of loving kindness. We always find fault, we always feel afraid. Only in loving kindness when we have that degree of trust can we actually let go. Just like the child can let go because it knows it's safe in the mother's arms. It's interesting, but from the first jhana to the second jhana, the difference between them is just trust. What is called in Pali Sampasadanam, Ajatang Sampasadanam. If you look at the Pali of the second jhana, the full complete trust in that nimitta. So much so that everything stops completely and is absolute, and I really mean absolute stillness. It's that lack of trust which manifests as fear, which manifests as the controller starting up again, which stops the deep meditations. So this is why loving kindness can actually develop those deep meditations and can help you, especially in the final stages before you enter the jhana, because it can give you that trust, that confidence to fully let go of the doer. But also the loving kindness is very useful afterwards as well, because the loving kindness is that, especially when it goes towards yourself, which is goodwill towards myself. And once you know what that goodwill is, as a feeling, as a mental state, then the next thing is, how do you achieve that goodwill to yourself? I mean, what really is in your best interests? And this is where that one realizes that which one has goodwill, loving kindness towards, you want to give it happiness, real peace. And so loving kindness becomes giving yourself the greatest gift of all, which is enlightenment. Going back to that simile of the lotus, the jewel in the heart of the lotus, the Dhamma. As that lotus opens up more and more and you get to its innermost heart, you know what that jewel is? Emptiness. Nothing in there. That is the jewel in the heart of the lotus. Anatta, sunyata. And to some people they think, what, I've warmed all this lotus up and gone to such a great deal of trouble and it's empty. But actually that is the jewel. That is the beauty of the Dhamma, to see the sunyata, the emptiness at the heart of everything. See, it's just a process, because that gives you the liberation. And that's the highest thing you can give for yourself. The loving kindness, the metta towards yourself so much that you give yourself full enlightenment. And that's also the best you can give to all other beings. So I was saying last night, the greatest gift you can give to another person is a gift of enlightenment. And only if you know what that enlightenment is, do you know what to give to others. That's the Paramahitaya in the Ratana Sutta, the gift of enlightenment, the gift of wisdom to all other beings. So this becomes both a path and an expression of that enlightenment. And this is what loving kindness is all about. If one doesn't know loving kindness, there is danger to loving kindness. And obviously the closest danger to loving kindness is affection. This is why you have to be very careful when doing loving kindness. If you don't do loving kindness properly, it can too easily lead to affection. Remember some years ago I was practicing loving kindness in West Australia. I was going down to a prison just south of Perth, and the only time that they would allow me to go in to talk to the prisoners was in the evening. So I used to get down there just after lunch, and there used to be a very nice beach down there. I used to go down by the beach to sit meditation. And this one particular time, I was sitting meditation down there and decided to do loving kindness meditation. And I remember, just as I closed my eyes, there was this boy and girl just passing me. And I must be meditating for about half an hour at least, doing loving kindness, may all beings be happy and well. And when I opened my eyes, I just looked not so far away. The boy and girl were kissing so amorously, and I realized that my loving kindness was actually not exactly achieving what I expected it to achieve. Because affection and loving kindness are very close together. But really what loving kindness should be, it should be a selfless wish for the happiness of other beings. So may all beings be happy and well, but also that you know what is happiness and what is well-being. So when you give that to other beings, you're giving them not just second-rate happiness, but the first-rate happiness. The happiness of peace, the happiness of liberation, and the happiness of the wisdom knowing of anatta. That's the highest gift you can give to other people. So if you really want to practice loving-kindness, make sure that it's loving-kindness which wishes people well, and you know what well is. And that becomes how you can practice loving-kindness. So that's a short talk this morning on loving-kindness. Any questions about what I've been saying today? On loving-kindness meditation. Wow, this is amazing, isn't it? No questions. Yeah. What a smile or in their eyes. Yeah. Indeed, I mean, like that someone once said that the eyes are the door to the soul, but what they really meant was the door to the heart. So you can actually see in a person's eyes the hatred there, or the happiness there, or the jealousy, or again the goodwill. But it's also sometimes in the smile. Sometimes it depends on the culture, because in Western culture, many often we're not supposed to smile. There's this one of the students who was an art teacher, so that he developed like a smile and was very happy to people, so he thought. And one day he smiled at one of his colleagues who was in a particularly bad mood, and his colleague hit him. And he's actually quite amazed, because, you know, he really floored him. And, you know, they're both supposed to be art teachers. But later on, many years later, he met him somewhere, and, you know, this disciple of mine who could have been floored was, you know, a bit wary of this fellow. This fellow came up to him and sort of said, "How are you going? I've really missed you. We used to be such good friends, didn't we?" And it's interesting, the perception that even though he'd hit this guy, you know, he'd realised that the guy was being friendly, and that's what he remembered. So sometimes you've got to be careful if you smile at the wrong time. But I think that's why maybe in some countries they use the eyes rather than the smile. Okay, there's no more, any questions? Okay. Well, yes, to give people the opportunity and the help towards enlightenment. Because you know, sometimes we give a person a gift, we think we're doing something good for them, but sometimes the gift which we give them, you know, is not really useful at all. You know, you can give sort of somebody a crate of wine, and you think you're giving them a nice gift, but you know, you're giving them a lot of problems. You may give them like an evening at the casino, but that's not really a gift. It's coming from goodwill, it's creating a lot of problems for them. So as well as having goodwill and compassion, one should also know what is wise. And this is one of the problems which I mentioned earlier, that if one has compassion without wisdom, one doesn't really know what one is doing. And goodwill doesn't reach its aim. So without wisdom, compassion is like a bow which has been well drawn and it's got a powerful arrow, but it's got no aim to it. And instead of hitting the target, it hits the bystanders. So compassion sometimes does that. It creates problems rather than solve problems, because it's not aimed with wisdom.
In the chant we do on loving kindness, this is sort of going away from the chapter, there's one line towards the end that talks about not holding to fixed views, that the Buddha didn't hold to fixed views.
No.
What were the fixed views that the Buddha didn't hold to?
Okay, yeah. Sometimes when that was first translated, a few of the monks groaned a little bit, because it's actually not that at all. It's actually not holding to wrong views. It's interesting with the idea of views, because again, some Western ideas of Buddhism were that you're supposed to have no views at all, and that you know, that the Buddha was supposed to be teaching no views. And I've heard that many times, and anyone can actually see that with a little bit of logic, that if you're not supposed to have any view, that's a view, so don't hold that one either. And it all comes from the use in Pali of the word ditti, which is a view. And that word is idiomatically always meaning, when it's by itself, it always means like wrong view. And when it's preceded by samma ditti, it's always right view. So there is such a thing as right view. There is such a thing as seeing that what's wise and what leads to nibbana and what doesn't lead to nibbana. So it's not as if all views are the same and all views have equal weight. There is a difference between right view and wrong view. And right view, that dualism there, is simply that which leads to nibbana is right view, and that which leads in the opposite direction is wrong view. So it's actually not really holding to fixed views, it's holding to wrong view. It's good to hold to the fixed view of, like this karma. It's good to hold to the fixed view that metta is a good thing to do. It's good to hold to fixed view that there is a result of giving generosity and keeping precepts. So those things are good to hold to. And that's the other one, which is where it says unburdened with duties in that chart. Actually, that at the time, they had a lot of burdens, a lot of duties. And so to avoid looking like hypocrites, like what most people do when they translate, they sort of bend a little bit here and twist a little bit there. So they say, oh yeah, we've got lots of duties, we're not burdened by them. That's what happens with translations sometimes, or with interpretations. We don't actually translate literally, but we translate what we want to believe. So it sort of it fits with our lifestyle. So actually, the word was having few duties.
Less an entreaty to simplify one's life.
Correct, absolutely, and that's out of loving kindness. And it makes it a lot of sense, isn't it? It's out of loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. So if you really are skilled in goodness, you know what goodness is, and you have loving kindness, that's what you should do. Simplify your life, unburden yourself with many of those duties.
Best thing to go is housework.
And the best way to lessen the housework is have smaller houses. And have lesser things in there. You know what it's like when you're sort of vacuuming or cleaning, and you've got to move all these stuff. And if you have less stuff in it, it's much easier to vacuum. How many rooms can you live in at a time? It's only one, isn't it? You don't really need all that much. Just one room. You can. Unfortunately, building regulations, you can't have simple houses anymore. So hard. Just need sort of a toilet and a shower and a little kitchen and a room to sleep in, and that's what people always used to have. The room they used to live in is to sleep in at night time. Don't have all these other rooms and guest rooms, and guests can have their own room in their own house. And how many times do you have guests? You know, be honest with it. Well, if you get guests from overseas, that's what hotels are there for. It's just that simplicity, but it's true. It's being unburdened with duties. It doesn't mean that. It means like having few duties, simplifying. Men know how to love also, because they've been mothers before as well. Many, many different lives, many different times. We've been mothers, we've been fathers, we've been everything. And it's always that which is lingering on from past lives, inclinations. And that's why, you know, you see some fathers and some men are just very, very kind, very, very soft. So it's very hard in this life for a woman to know a man, for a man to know what a woman is like. But that's why I was saying this the other day to somebody. This is what the monks in Thailand used to say. And it all came about because when I was a very young monk at the end of the line, I was, you know, really looking forward to becoming a senior monk. Because the young monks, you used to get the last of the food and you used to have to do all the work. I thought it was really unfair. You know, the people who got the best food, which, you know, because we pass the food down the line, the people who got the best food should do the most work. And also I noticed the senior monks, they got the more cushions. And they'd been practicing sitting on the concrete for years, and, you know, their bones were nice, and or their bones were soft, and they had lots of padding under their bottom, and they didn't need those cushions. Me, I was just the young monk from England. I was the one who needed all the cushions. And so as a young monk, I wanted to be a senior monk. And when I became a senior monk, I started looking down the line. These young monks, they've got nothing to do. They just sit there all day. They're not able to talk to people and give retreats. I have to do all the work. And it wouldn't be wonderful to be a junior monk again. I can just meditate all day. And when I started talking about that, the monk started giving me this very old teaching. And it's a very beautiful teaching. He said, young monks have young monk suffering. Middle monks have middle monk suffering. And senior monks have senior monk suffering. And the young monk doesn't know the senior monk suffering. The senior monk can't remember the young monk suffering. And he said, like women have women suffering. They don't know men suffering. And men have men suffering. They don't know women suffering. Children have children suffering. Wives have wives suffering. And men, husbands have husbands suffering. And we think, once we get rid of this suffering, if I could only be a man, or if I could only be a woman, if I could only be old, if I could only be young, if I could only be retired. When you're retired, you have retired person suffering. So, people like to... So, it's true, we get rid of one suffering, but we take up another suffering. So, if you're poor, you have poor person suffering. And you think, if I only can win the lotto and become rich, then I'll be happy. It's true, you get rid of poor people's suffering, but you get rich person suffering. And rich people have suffering as well. So it's just different types of suffering you have. So I've noticed that with, like, the gender problems, we always think that, you know, poor me, I'm the only one who suffers, and other people haven't got suffering. We look upon the boss at work, you know, they're all right, but us workers. Workers have workers' suffering, bosses have boss suffering. That's the nature of our life. Yeah?
If I don't know that distinction between different kinds of suffering and poor kinds of suffering, I happened to say that, well, not so eloquently, the other day to somebody, they said, I'd still rather be rich and unhappy rather than poor and unhappy.
Because they're poor now, because they don't know what it's like over there. The old grass on the other side of the fence, similarly. Actually, I remember reading about this story where this farmer had hay, which was last season's hay, and was already getting quite mouldy. And being quite parsimonious, you know, always not liking to waste money, he just put the hay out for his cows to eat and gave them nothing else to eat. But even though the cows were going hungry, they refused to eat the mouldy hay. So, thinking next what to do, he mixed the mouldy hay with some new hay, mixed it all together, thinking that way he'll get rid of it. And the cows, very deliberately, they took all the nice hay, separated it out, and they only ate the nice hay, and he still was left with all his mouldy hay. And he didn't know what to do with it until he got a brainwave. He saw, as you'd see in many fields, you know, the cows are always poking their heads through the barbed wire fence just to nibble the grass just on the other side. That's what he did. He put all the mouldy hay outside the field, on the other side of the fence, but just close enough, if they really stretched, they could get it. And it was gone within a day. Even for cows, the very fact it was prohibited, and it was the other side of the fence, and they were not supposed to eat it, they ate it all. And this is what happens, because it's something which is that outside of our reach, we think it's going to be delicious and beautiful. And so for the poor person, they really think that being a rich person is going to be happy. They really think that grass on the other side of the fence is going to be delicious. But once you are rich, and you realize that there's lots of poor person suffering you've let go of and disappeared, but you've got rich person suffering. So a different quality of suffering, but it's still suffering. It's the same as bosses suffering and workers suffering. You know, your children suffering and parents suffering. She would have gone, why could I be a parent and I can tell you what to do for a change? And of course, you know, when you can't tell other people what to do, that's telling other people what to do suffering. Rather than being told suffering. So there's different types of suffering. But going back to the other question about like loving kindness, does one love oneself most of all, or just like a mother loves her only child? This was like a metaphor which the Buddha gave of that degree of like selflessness towards another being, just like a mother loves her only child. But the child in that metaphor is basically oneself. One is one's own child. And even though the mother would love her children, I would still say that she loves herself more in the long term. There are times when she loves the child and she'll look after the child. There's also most of her life she'll be loving herself.
Well, women often see their children as extensions of themselves anyway.
They do, yes, yeah. Because their child hurts and they hurt.
In regards to your comment about sitting forward about the work environment, how do you reconcile that effort to be positive and have merit towards the workplace or what people work with when the workplace is often alienating or producing meaningless, you know, products that just contribute to an unsimplified lifestyle, or when you constantly faced with the fact that it's quite meaningless, or even a negative work environment.
Again, you asked the question when work looks meaningless, and you've got to find somewhere putting meaning into it. So you give it meaning. You know, if it's at the very least, it's teaching you a bit of self-discipline. This is what I, you know, was teaching people when they were studying maths at school. They came up, you know, what good is maths? You know, when I sort of go and get a job, I don't need to know Pythagoras' theorem and the cos of this and the sine of that. What's all this for anyway? And the argument was, look, this is actually training your mind, disciplining. You know, when you play soccer or footy, I mean, you're not going to be lifting weights. But it's good to lift weights because that's training your muscles to be strong. So you always find some way of putting meaning sort of into what you're doing. Even if it's the most boring job you can possibly imagine. You know, like just putting labels on bottles all day.
Mm-hmm.
Patience. You're learning patience. Well, I mean, associating with the wise. The wise are the peaceful, and bottles are very peaceful. Like I say, this is very wise.
I'm just thinking of so many work environments which are really, you know, challenging to people's psyche and produce very different, or, you know, the advertising industry or something like that.
Well, I mean, I give an example of, from my experience of when I came back from prison life, because prison is a very negative environment. And there's this one prisoner who was, I was giving my talks on loving kindness, may all beings be happy and well, and loving everybody, and he was so saying, well, look, that might be okay in a monastery, but in the real world, especially in the prison, it's a hard place. You can't practice loving kindness here. And I'm always in for a challenge, so I challenged him. And I asked him straight away, who's your biggest enemy in this prison? Who's the person you hate the most? And straight away he told me about this prison officer who he had to work for, because he'd been given the job of making tea and coffee to the administrative officers in the prison. He said, there's one of these prison officers who was just so nasty to him, and nasty to all the other prisoners. He's what they call in prison slang a dog. And he gave me an example. He said, just the last week, one of the prisoners' wives had come to visit. And this prison officer had saw the wife coming in, recognized her, and straight away got hold of this prisoner and sent him to the other side of the prison on some sort of errand. And the prisoner had to go. And then once the prisoner's wife had logged in, they made an announcement over the PA system, would prisoner so-and-so come to the visitor's area, your wife is here. But he'd been sent to a prison, part of the prison where there was no PA system. And so they were all looking around for this prisoner, where's he gone, where is he? And this prison officer kept absolutely quiet. And they actually found him. I'm terribly sorry, but the visiting hours are over now. Better back next week. And doing that for no other reason than just to, you know, out of ill will to this prisoner. So, you know, he was really a rotten person. And as soon as he told me this story, I said, great. The sort of person you can change with loving kindness. And so I told him, every time you make a cup of tea or a cup of coffee for this dog, make sure you give it a biscuit, not biscuit. No, get something nice, nice for him. And make the cup of tea and coffee as delicious as you can, with putting as much kindness and care in as possible. And say something nice to him every day, and see what happens. And I used to go every week to teach meditation. And every week I'd go there and say, what's happening? And every week he'd say nothing. It's just a waste of time. I really try hard. I make really nice tea, really nice coffee, and get some biscuits, and he just ignores me. He doesn't even turn around. I put the cup on his desk and he doesn't move. It's just I don't exist. But this prisoner was very good. He kept on trying, kept on going. I still remember the prisoner's name, Nick, and he kept on trying. And it was about 3 months when we got our first breakthrough. And he made a delicious cup of coffee that day with some very nice biscuits he managed to scrounge from somewhere. It's amazing what you can scrounge in prisons. And he came to his prison officer and said, look, I found you some nice biscuits and a beautiful cup of coffee. I think just as you like it, hope you enjoy it. And the prison officer, without moving, said, ugh. And that grunt was very significant. At last, see, that she acknowledged the prisoner actually existed by grunting. And we talked about that and we realised this is the breakthrough we were looking for. This is the crack. And it was true, it was only another month when he got some very nice tea and some sandwiches or something and gave it to the prison officer, you know, with a sort of nice smile and said, I hope you really enjoy this, sir. And the prison officer turned around and said, thank you. And that just blew this prisoner away. I won. And apparently he told me it went all around the prisoner that this prison officer said thank you to a prisoner. Then he understood then that loving kindness works. After that prisoner was released, I was at the airport one day and I felt the hand on my shoulder. And I turned around, it was this ex-prisoner, Nick. He smiled at me and said, his first words was, I'm still doing my meditation, Brian. Which was really nice. So loving kindness can change people. But it takes a lot of persistence, even in the workplace. But once you get the first grunt, then you're away. So it's, you know, what you do with the situation there, and you can use it as a training area. This other story, this is, again, it's a metaphor. This is an old story, but it's got a good message behind it. And this was like an old Christian story. That this Christian priest was giving a sermon one day, and just after the sermon, one of the new members of the congregation happened to be a philosophy professor from a local university. And after the sermon had finished, this professor did what you're not supposed to do in church. He put his hand up and said, can I ask a question? And the priest was completely sort of taken aback, because that never happens. But he had to say, okay, what's the question? And the priest said this, according to your sermon, you've just said that to go to heaven you have to believe in God. He said there's been many atheists in history who've been very wonderful people, you know, such as the Buddha, and such as people like Marcus Aurelius, people like Gandhi, who else was there? Many sort of Voltaire. Many sort of very good people, very wise people. They didn't believe to God. What happened to them? Good people like that, like Gandhi, do they have to go to hell? And the priest was smart enough to say, well, that's a big question. I'll answer that next week. And on the following Monday, the priest had the day off. So he didn't even think about how he was going to answer that question. But on Tuesday, he went to his study and read through his books. And he couldn't get a satisfactory answer an answer which would satisfy him, let alone satisfy a philosophy professor. So he made an appointment with one of his fellow priests, who was a bit senior than him, on the Wednesday, and went to discuss it with him. And this senior priest, that's a really tricky one. If I was you, I'd go and see the bishop. So I went to see the bishop on Thursday, and the bishop said, that really is tricky, archbishop. So I went to see the archbishop on Friday, and the archbishop said, I don't know how to answer that question, go and see the theologians. So on a Saturday he went to see the theologians, and the theologians gave him an answer, but it was so convoluted, and he couldn't really remember it because it was just all gobbledygook. So on Saturday night he still didn't have an answer, and he was going to have to give a sermon the following morning. And he was worried so much he hardly slept all night. And like any good priest, he did what the only thing he could think of was to go to the church first thing in the morning and start praying for guidance. And as he was praying, he fell asleep, because he hardly slept at all. And as soon as he started sleeping, he had this dream. It was one of these prophetic dreams, very clear. This is only a metaphor, so if you're Buddhist, don't get upset about this. In this dream, he was at a railway station. And he knew intuitively where the train standing on the platform was going to. But he asked the conductor, he said, this train over here, wouldn't be going to a place called heaven, would it? And the train conductor said, yes, it is. And seeing you're a priest, you can go up there for free. So he got on the train, and in a very short while, in his dream, he arrived at this platform, and on the side of the platform was written the words H-E-A-V-E-N, heaven. So he got out of the train, and he walked over to the first person he saw, who was wearing a little white gown with a little ring over his head. And he said, excuse me, sir, so what's this place called? And he said, it's called heaven, welcome. Oh, great. He said, now, how long have you been here? And this man said, I lived up here for thousands of years. Very interesting. Do you know anyone up here by the name of the Buddha, or Marcus Aurelius, or Gandhi, or Voltaire? Gandhi, Voltaire, never heard of them. And he thought, I've got my answer. And so he went back to the train station, and there was another train on another platform. And again, he knew where it was going. So he asked the conductor, and he said, that train over there wouldn't be going down to a place called hell, would it? He said, yes, it is. So he said, can I have a return ticket, please? So he got his return ticket, and in a short while, he got to this station, and on the station was written the letters H-E-L-L. And so he got outside, and he went to the... Actually, before he even got to the first person, he was a bit surprised, because it was nothing like he expected. There wasn't actually people being tortured or people hurting at all. And this time, actually, he didn't need to go and approach someone. Someone came to see him and said, hi, welcome. How are you? What can we do for you? Do you want a cup of tea? He said, look, I'll have a cup of tea later, but thank you for being so kind and welcoming. But what's this place called? He said, it's hell. Welcome here. Are you sure you don't want a cup of tea? Would you prefer some coffee instead? And he was just so kind and attending. He said, look, is this really hell? I said, yeah, this is hell. Welcome. Now, what about that cup of tea? And he said, look, I'll have a cup of tea later, first of all, but I'm a bit surprised, he said, about this, because it's not really what I expected. But because I always expected sort of hell to be worse than this. But first of all, tell me, is anyone down here by the name of, like, Gandhi? Said, oh, yeah, wonderful fella. Marcus Aurelius, Voltaire, the Buddha, oh, tremendous people. And the priest was just really surprised. He said, look, according to my religion, I expected all these people to be here. But I expected this place to be a place of torment and torture and ill will and terrible places, terrible things happening down here. And this man smiled at him. He said, well, you know, it used to be like that until the Buddha came down here and Gandhi and Voltaire. And that's an old Christian story. And the moral of that story, it is, it's not the place makes the people. It's the people make the place. And so it's not as if your workplace is hell. You make it hell. If the Buddha went to your workplace, he would sort it out in no time. So if you could sort it out, make it a good place. That's an old sort of Christian story which I remember from years ago, and it's a very pertinent one. And so if any of the Christians ask you, said, well, according to our religion, sort of, you know, people don't believe in Jesus, go to hell, and all those good people, they'd make sort of hell a lovely place. But I don't want to offend anyone, because obviously, you know, the Buddha doesn't go to hell, doesn't go to heaven, doesn't get reborn. So any other comments or questions on that little story? Even like a meditation retreat. Meditation retreat isn't hell, isn't heaven, it's what you make of it. So it's what you add to the perceptions of life. And that's why any meditation which you're experiencing, that you have the opportunity every moment so to turn it into a heavenly meditation. It's really sort of your perception. And that's one of the wonderful things to read in the Buddhist suttas, that one of the powers of the Aryans, the liberated, the wise ones, is the power over that perception. The power to see the beautiful in the unpleasant, and also the unpleasant in the beautiful, whenever they think it's worthwhile. So this is what we can do. Okay, that's enough for today, folks.